I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. He's performed at Carnegie Hall alongside jazz legends Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan, and now he's in Kansas City. Today we speak with renowned guitarist John Scofield, find out what's bringing him here to Kansas City, and how he's helping to celebrate our own jazz scene. Then a journey back over there. Where? Well, to France, of course. We'll revisit the battleground sites of World War I 100 years after the conflict, and why, for the French, the war is more than just a memory. After that, the latest edition of State House Blend. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If a career in music includes an early appearance at Carnegie Hall with the likes of Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan, and more than four decades later, a Grammy win for Best Instrumental Jazz Album, that strikes us as pretty sweet. Along the way, John Scofield played with a guy named Miles Davis and produced a few dozen albums under his own name as well. John Scofield has been called one of the big three jazz guitarists of the late 20th and early 21st century, along with Pat Metheny and Bill Frisell. John Scofield plays this weekend at the Kansas City Jazz and Heritage Festival. Here's a track from that Grammy-winning album. This is Country for Old Men from the 2016 track Wildwood Flower. John Scofield, welcome.
Hi.
How did you manage to launch a career with a gig at Carnegie Hall with the likes of Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan?
With Chet and Jerry. Well, I didn't launch it, really. That's just the first recording I was ever on. I'd been, practicing and trying to get good for years and years before that, but I was, in 74, I was 22, I guess. But I'd been, working my butt off for 10 years before that.
We regard those guys today as jazz legends. Did you regard them back the same way back in 1974?
Yeah, absolutely. And I still do. Those are my idols.
How did they treat a young kid back then?
Well, really nicely. Both those guys were really nice to me. I played with Jerry a lot, Jerry Mulligan, and I was in his band. And, he was wonderful. And, most of the musicians you meet are the jazz guys. They're great.
At least a little intimidating, though, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, I was shaking in my boots. And they knew that, so they were extra nice, maybe. I think they could relate,
Then to fast forward, 40 years, John, to 2016, and to win the Grammy for Best Instrumental Jazz Album, that's a nice bookend. In fact, I think it was your second in a row in that category. Tell us about Country for Old Men, where you went a little bit country on us. What were you aiming for there?
Well, we went a little bit country. I've always loved the country tunes. I started out with kind of folk music and the folk boom in the 60s when I was a little kid, and so I've always been aware of that music. It's part of America. And I especially love the old songs, and I knew that we could do modern jazz versions of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. It worked easily, actually. And everybody in the band wanted to do it, and that's what we'll be playing this weekend in Kansas City.
I was going to ask you, because on the album, you got tracks on here from Hank Williams, Dolly Parton, James Taylor, and Merle Haggard, and a whole bunch of others. That's covering some ground, isn't it?
Yeah, and you've got to hear it, because we really turn it into jazz, you know? And that's the thing, is these easy three-chord tunes, you can do a lot with them. You can swing anything, and that's what we did.
Let's listen to one more track from Country for Old Men. This is Wayfaring Stranger, and I love this one. That's Wayfaring Stranger from John Scofield, his latest disc, Country for Old Men. He'll be performing at the Kansas City Jazz and Heritage Festival this Friday night at 8:30 on the main stage in the 18th and Vine District. Bobby Watson, Karn Ellison, Brandy, Kevin Mahogany, Regina Carter, and the Hot Sardines will also be performing. Tickets, AmericanJazzMuseum.org. John, at this point in your career, what's the particular challenge of putting out one more album?
Well, you know, coming up with something that's a little different from what you've done before. I've made 40 albums, and it almost feels like it's not worth it to just do the same old stuff. Even though, you know, jazz, because it's jazz and we improvise, it's different all the time, so you can do that. But I feel that it's, you know, I've got to do a little bit different angle on it, and so that's the challenge, thinking of something you haven't quite done before.
You know, it's been a while since you were in Kansas City. What's kept you away?
Oh, nothing's
a good
kept
gig.
Me away. You better ask the people that promote shows in Kansas City what keeps me away.
Get them in here.
I'm excited to come back.
Yeah. Between 82 and 85, 1985, you toured with a guy named Miles Davis. This would have been getting late in his career. I got to ask about it. That must have been a trip.
Well, it was wonderful. Yeah, and it was a trip. You know, Miles was a whole thing. And he'd always been my idol. You know, his music, I was a huge fan and learned so much. All of us in jazz did. He was maybe the greatest voice, you know, that was playing at that time, especially. And as a student of the music, boy, it sure was great to hang out with him and hear him play every night. And as far as playing, to play with him, that's how in jazz you really learn. Is, you know, you hear somebody blow on the same tune you're about to take your thing on, and then you get up and try and do the same thing. When you do it with a master like Miles, it stays with you forever. And I was very lucky to get to hang with him.
Was it fun to play with him, John, or was it scary to play with a master like that?
Oh, scary. You know, I mean, like we're talking about with Jerry and Chet.
Yeah.
Actually, Miles was, I think he enjoyed intimidating people.
Yes, that was his thing, right?
I played with Miles for almost 3 years straight, you know, in his band. He worked a lot. And I think the first year I really was pretty much scared, you know. And then after a while, I got into it, and the second half I was in heaven, you know. And is it fun? Fun's not even enough of you know, it's exhilarating in the highest sense and rewarding in a way that you know, you can imagine just getting to do what you've always wanted to do, and to hear and to be part of this magnificent thing that's happening on stage.
When he was mad at you, how would you know it?
Well, he was always mad at everybody.
It just was part of the thing, right?
That was what Miles did, yeah, you know. And in a way, you didn't take it that seriously because you, but you know what? He was funny. He could be really nice. And you know, but you didn't quite expect Miles to be, you know, this guy that you would have a normal relationship. I didn't anyway. So it was cool.
I was going to say, did you develop a relationship with him on any personal level, or did it not just never go there?
Yeah. I mean, personal enough for him. Yeah, he would, you know, call you up, and he did this with all the guys. That's who he hung out with, were the guys who worked for him. We were his social life.
He'd call you up and say what, John?
Pardon me?
He'd call you up and say what?
Oh, yeah, he'd call up and talk about music, be playing the tapes of the gigs. He would either call you up and curse you out for doing something wrong, or he would call you up and compliment you, which was amazing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then he liked to talk about Charlie Parker. He liked to talk about Coltrane. Huh. He liked to talk about what he liked in current music. He liked to talk about jazz, what his feelings were about the creative process. It was a wonderful experience getting to hear him talk about music.
You know, a few months ago, Mark Meyer, who's been on this show, posted on his Jazz Wax blog a video of Miles playing Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time.
Uh-huh.
Lauper later said this was her favorite version of the song. And, John, of course, you're on it. Let's listen to a little bit of Miles Davis playing Time After Time with John Scofield. You know, there he is, John, in this video, which just absolutely dropped my jaw. You know, Miles, his head's down, sweat on his forehead, sunglasses, oblivious to the audience, lots of crack notes, playing this incredible melody. I'm wondering, this was one of his favorite sort of standard songs toward the end, right?
Yeah. This was a big thing when Miles, he did a couple of current pop tunes in the 80s, you know, that were current then when we recorded them, Time After Time and Human Nature by Michael Jackson.
Right, right.
And people really loved his interpretation when he would play those songs. And before that, we'd been doing these very abstract kind of funk jams, you know?
Right.
And then all of a sudden there were these tunes and they could hold on to them in a way. In a way, like when he played My Funny Valentine and tunes like that in the 50s.
Right.
You know, he was a great melodist, and it was spellbinding when he would do that.
Oh, no kidding. I'm visiting with guitarist John Schofield. Why did you end up playing the guitar, John? What drew you to the guitar as opposed to the French horn or something?
Oh, well, because guitar was cool.
Mm-hmm.
And because the guitar was what the rock and roll groups did on TV when I was 11 and got a guitar. You know, it was to be like that, to be like the older high school kids that my older sister knew that played in an old rock band. That's the whole thing, was rock and roll that got me into guitar.
You were born in Dayton, Ohio, not exactly a hotbed of jazz, but then you were in Connecticut for high school. Mm-hmm. How did you make your way to jazz?
Well, you know, like I said, I started with rock as a kid, you know, but I knew, you know, there was this higher purpose in music. Not to sound like a jazz snob, but I guess I am.
Yeah.
And you know, I loved blues and R&B, and there would be a little solo, you know, on the pop 45s, and this guy would play a thing, you know. And then I realized early on, even before I had listened to a whole lot of jazz, that jazz was like that. It was like the solo,
mm-hmm.
but it was extended. You know, the other rock musicians that were older than me would say, oh, yeah, there's this thing called jazz that's like, you know, it's even higher form. So this was something that I could get to, you know, that was really substantial, and you know, which classical music was too, but I wasn't going to do that. The whole jazz mystique got me right away, you know, these people who improvise, and I just... I love the idea that everybody could have their own personality in the music.
Who were your jazz heroes back in those days?
Oh, the jazz guitarists. Well, I love Jim Hall, Pat Martino,
sure.
George Benson, Wes Montgomery, of course. And before them, I was a B.B. King blues fanatic.
Early on, you also played with a guy named Charles Mingus, the bassist, who was known for his volcanic temper. How did you navigate that?
Well, I only played with Mingus on one recording.
Ah.
He decided to augment his group with guitars, and it was a record called Three or Four Shades of Blues. And, you know, I didn't have much personal contact with him outside of showing up, rehearsing, and playing for a day at 1841 West 60th Street, which was Atlantic Records recording studio, a legendary place. I think I got the address right. I can't believe I remember that.
Yeah.
But he got real sick right after that. It was the last record he ever played on. He
wow.
had Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah.
And he was nice to us, but like I said, it didn't have much to do with me. But after I left, the trumpet player who was in his band, Jack Walrus, said, yeah, you know, Mingus dug you. And so I thought, whew, okay. And I met him on the record. But yeah, you know, I was scared of him too. But
yeah.
At this point, you know, I was so used to being scared every day of these guys that I just lived scared, you know. So I thought, oh, I'm scared again. Here I am. Oh.
Well, you're regarded, as I mentioned in the intro, as one of the big three of modern jazz guitarists, along with Pat Metheny, who's from around here, and Bill
That's
Frisell.
What I heard. Yeah, he's local.
Local guy. Not bad guys to be associated with, John.
No, Pat's incredible. I met Pat, you know, when he was still a teenager, and I was probably like 20 or something, and before he was famous. But he was already getting there, and he had just started playing with Gary Burton. Incredible musician and a giant, really, and more than even just a guitar player. He's a whole.
Yeah.
I always thought he was the Steven Spielberg of jazz. The way he orchestrated the music and put together the Pat Metheny group.
Yeah,
incredible. All from Lee Summit, right?
Lee
there.
Summit, Missouri, just not far from here at all. And I want to go out with your latest project. You've teamed up with a new all-star band, drummer Jack DeJohnette, who was just in town, bassist Larry Grenadier, and keyboardist John Medeski for an album titled Hudson. It's due out next month. I want to go out with that. In the meantime, I want to point out that John Schofield, again, plays at 8:30 Friday night, the Kansas City Jazz and Heritage Festival. Lots of big names coming to town this weekend. More information, tickets, AmericanJazzMuseum.org. John, what a pleasure it's been.
Oh, Steve, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for promoting the show, and I can't wait to get out to Kansas City.
I'll be in the crowd Friday night, John. I'll look forward to it.
See you then.
Let's go out with a track from Hudson. This is John Scofield and others. The track, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. Time for a break. When we come back, a new way to look at World War I. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, Fighting Terrorism with Entrepreneurship, we'll find out how economic opportunity curtails extremism. Well, so many Americans have forgotten World War I, and in a way, how can you blame them? America's entrance into the worldwide conflict came 100 years ago this year. But to many of the French, the war remains something that is very much alive. Walk the fields where the war took place, and you'll come across artifact after artifact, buttons, bombs and bunkers, trenches and tunnels. People can't believe that all these artifacts are still out there. Author Richard Rubin can't believe they're surprised. Richard Rubin tracked down the war's last survivors for his previous book, The Last of the Doughboys. Now he's back with something of a sequel, Back Over There, that tells the story of World War I from the standpoint of what the war left behind. Richard Rubin, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about those artifacts that are still out there. What can you find, and where do you go to find them?
Well, the what is pretty much anything men carried with them to war.
Yeah.
Everything from the things they brought to kill each other, bullets, shells, shrapnel. Shrapnel is probably the single most common thing you find out there. Knives, bayonets, to the things they brought along just to keep themselves together while they were out there during this awful carnage. I found combs that men brought. I found spoons that they brought to eat with, canteens they brought to drink from, mess kits, buttons of their uniform, pretty much everything that they carried out there, and they carried an awful lot.
You say in the book that some of these pieces are just lying there on top of the earth like they've been waiting for someone to come along for a long time to pick them up, and that's surprising, right? It just sits there right in front of you.
Well, you don't expect that something could spend 100 years sitting in the same spot and not move. And you asked about the where. The where is anywhere that men fought or anywhere that men traveled in order to fight. And yes, in certain parts of France, every time fields are plowed, new things come up. And in other parts of France, every time you step foot into any patch of woods, you'll find things just resting atop the fallen leaves. And we really think that 100 years is a very long time and nothing should remain from that time. But again, there was just an awful lot of this stuff. And experts actually predict that it's going to keep being plowed up for another 200 to 300 years.
There are objects also which you shouldn't pick up, dangerous things. Tell us about those.
Well, anything that was meant to explode and thus kill you, but that didn't explode, is something that you shouldn't touch. And I learned this, I'm happy to tell you, not quite the hard way, but almost the hard way. The first time I was over there in 2009, I saw a little shell, maybe 6 inches long. I thought, oh, that's cute. And I bent over to pick it up, and a French fellow I was out there with pretty much saved my life, because I found out later that this was an American shell, a 37 millimeter, and it's seriously unstable. Mm. And in fact, we think that the older things are, the less dangerous they are. But when it comes to ordnance, the opposite is true. And most of these shells had not only explosive in them, but also gas. So they can hurt you any number of ways. An interesting statistic that sounds like it can't possibly be true.
I was just going to cite it to you. Go ahead.
Is that more shells were fired in the First World War that did not explode than the total number of shells that were fired in the Second World War.
I read that three times. I couldn't believe it when I came across it.
It sounds unbelievable, and yet it is absolutely true. More shells were fired at the start of the Meuse-Argonne offensive at the end of World War I, the last 47 days. More shells were fired on the first morning of that than the total number that were fired by the Union Army in all of the Civil War.
I mean, these shells that turn up, they turn up every day. So what happens to them?
Well, if you're out with somebody conscientious, like my friend Jean-Paul DeVries, who saved my life that morning back in 2009, he carries around a can of fluorescent orange spray paint.
Yes.
And whenever he comes across a shell, he coats it thoroughly. And the first time he did this, I said, "Is that for the bomb squad?" And he laughed and he said, "No, the police won't come out for anything less than like 20 shells. If they did, they would never do anything else. That's for the farmer." And I've met farmers who keep these things in their barns. They just, you know, or sometimes at the start of a season, they'll lay out a bright blue tarp somewhere in their field, and that will be their ammunition depot. And for the rest of the year, whatever they find, they'll transport very gingerly to this bright blue tarp. And maybe by the end of the year, they'll have enough for it to be worth the bomb squad's while. But if not, they'll just take it and store it in their barn.
You met a man named Jean-Paul DeVries, if I'm saying that right. He's a longtime collector. He started a museum but didn't charge people to come inside, and I'm wondering why not.
Well, I think his philosophy is he didn't pay for anything that's in the museum. It was offered up to him for free by the earth. And so it didn't feel right to him, I think, to charge people admission. Of course, he has a can and he gladly accepts donations. He certainly needs them to keep the museum going. But I don't think he felt that he could turn around and charge people to see things that he found for free, especially given the nature of the things that he has on display at his museum. And the fact that some of them may very well have been involved in killing or maiming the ancestors of some of the people who are now coming to see them.
Hmm. We're talking about lots of usually small things here. And then there are bigger things like bunkhouses and trenches. 100 years later, it's amazing that some of the trenches still exist. And I'm wondering, how can that be and what do they look like?
Well, there are two types of trenches that you find over in France, dirt and concrete. The concrete trenches are almost all German. And I give a lot of talks all over the country. I spoke at the museum, the World War I Museum in Kansas City a few weeks ago. And I have a PowerPoint to accompany my talks. And sometimes there's a slide of one of these old German concrete trenches. And people will ask me, how long did it take them to restore that? And it didn't take them any time to restore it because it wasn't restored at all. It was just so well built 100 years ago that it just looks very much like it did back then. Now, dirt trenches are different. Everybody built dirt trenches, including the Germans. But again, if you see them in person, there's really no mistaking them for what they are. They're deeper than ditches. They were when they were new, probably 8 to 10 feet deep. They run on for a very long time. Usually it's you can't really find the beginning and the end of one. And they zigzag. Trenches were never dug straight because if the enemy were able to get into your trench and the trench were straight, he could just fire a rifle forever and kill as many people as he wished. And so trenches zigzagged every 10 feet or so. And they often intersect at right angles with other trenches. And so really there's just no mistaking them for anything else. They don't occur in nature.
Richard Rubin's my guest. His latest book titled Back Over There. How are European battlefields different from the ones in this country? And I'm thinking about battlefields like Gettysburg. Can you find artifacts at Gettysburg like you can in France?
I'm laughing. It's not a silly question, but, you know, in the book, I actually draw that analogy between Gettysburg and the Western Front, and I say it's like comparing watching a documentary on TV to traveling back in time.
Yes.
Maybe you can find something at Gettysburg. I never have and have never heard of anyone who has. What you can find at Gettysburg, in fact, what you can't really avoid, are monuments and memorials.
Yes.
They're just absolutely everywhere you look. And so Gettysburg does not look like a battlefield. It looks like a beautiful natural park with perhaps an overabundance of monuments and memorials and statuary. The Western Front is very different for many reasons. First of all, its scale is just vaster by an order of magnitude. It was a 500-mile line that stretched from the English Channel in the northwest down to the Swiss border in the southeast. And after the war, France had lost more than 1 million men in combat and an untold number of civilians. They just didn't have the manpower or the financial resources to restore and rehabilitate most of the land along the Western Front. And so it was just left as it is. And that's really wonderful for somebody like me who wants to come along 100 years later and get a sense of what it was all like. But it's not something that they did by design. It was just a concession they had to make to the realities of post-war life.
You know, I thought this was interesting. In the course of your research, you came across all these resident experts, if you will, who know a lot about one particular aspect of the war, usually confined to one very specific area, but they don't know much about interesting tidbits of what happened just outside their zone or their region. What did you make of that?
Well, you know, the Great War, World War I, is so vast that if you don't want to be overwhelmed, you kind of have to focus on one specific thing. And these are people who are fascinated with the subject in general, but no human being has the bandwidth to go that deep into the subject at large. And so these are people who focus on a specific area or a specific event or a specific day. And they're the masters, as I write, of that particular fiefdom. And I think, frankly, to preserve their own sanity, they don't stray outside that fiefdom. And so I was very fortunate to meet quite a few of these people in different sectors along the Western Front who truly have mastered the history of that particular area. Sometimes it's just a single village. Sometimes it's larger than that. Sometimes it's just part of a town. But these people know that area. They know that battle. They know that part of that battle. And they're so passionate about it that speaking to them about it, you often get the sense that they were there. And I just think it works out well for everybody because there isn't a lot of internecine fighting. You know, people define their turf and, you know, they don't have to worry about what some other person is doing 40 miles to the west. You know, it's it works out for the best that way, I think.
You talk a lot in Back Over Time about all these different World War I battlefields in Europe and in northeast France. Which one is the most worth visiting in your view? If you could just do one.
Well, if you can just do one, I would recommend the Argonne. It's the largest where Americans fought. It's by far the most well-preserved, just naturally. The Argonne, Jean-Paul Devry said to me once that the poverty of that region has preserved its history. The land just wasn't valuable enough to rehabilitate after the war. If you go further to the west, closer to Paris, areas where Americans fought, particularly Champagne country, that land was too valuable to leave as it was. Plus, it was only fought over for a couple of months in 1918. The Argonne was the site of a 4-year, 3-month, and 2-week battle. And the woods and the heights and the ravines, everywhere you go, they're just filled with artifacts, with bunkers, with trenches. No kiosks around. It's just you and history. At the same time, the Argonne is probably the hardest place for Americans to visit. It's quite far from Paris. There aren't American-style hotels there. When I go, I stay in bed and breakfasts. Nobody speaks any English. So it's not necessarily the most American tourist-friendly place. But if you can only pick one sector of the Western Front as an American to visit, I would say that's it. It's also, frankly, the most historically significant. This was the last great battle of World War I, and it really was what broke the back of the German Empire.
Well, Richard Rubin's latest book, Back Over There, it's an excellent read. I really enjoyed it. And thanks so much for taking some time with us today, Richard. I sure appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
It's time now for State House Blend, Kansas. Yesterday, moderate Republicans in the House supported the bill to repeal Governor Sam Brownback's controversial tax cuts. But the bill failed because only half of the chamber's Democrats voted for it. First, they want to know how much the state needs to spend on schools to comply with a Kansas Supreme Court ruling. Republican Representative Melissa Rooker joins host Sam Zeff and KCUR's Jim McLean to talk about her draft of a new school funding formula.
I want to ask about, you've been in the room with Speaker Reichman and Chairman Campbell as you plan how to roll this out. First, we had the big caucus meeting. There'll be plans, be planning on how to manage the bill on the floor. You've clearly emerged as the leader of that moderate writ large, right, however that umbrella group is. Do you feel some additional pressure to bring this bill or to compromise, find compromise between all these various groups? Because now, I mean, you really have to lead on this.
Well, it's what I will say, Sam, is there's no controlling faction. So there's
That's
no
the big issue.
Group of people who have the voting block large enough to run the show. So,
but they clearly believe that you're one of the people who can help create that coalition, no?
Well, I am working to. And it's necessary to be statesmen and to find the compromise that we can agree on. I mean, that's our job. Nobody is going to get exactly what they want. And as people realize that, it becomes easier to begin to find points of agreement. So, yeah, I am trying to work through this to bring forward the best structure in terms of the formula. I can't stress enough, that is, for me, the most important thing. We can argue all day long about dollars going into the formula, but I have to remind people, we will not have the authority to send even $1 out to our school districts come July 1st without a proper formula. So that is the most important issue we're dealing with. The money, we can agree, we can disagree, we can settle. Whatever we send to the court will be evaluated. And I trust in the process. The state will argue the case for why we sent what we sent. The plaintiffs will argue the case for what they want, and we've got a Supreme Court that's in charge of deciding who got it right.
You seem to suggest that we're a little stalled. We're not moving as fast as perhaps you would like. What is alarming you about this?
There are things that begin to happen in June ahead of that June 30th deadline that have to, you know, certain steps have to be taken. There is the final pay period for state employees overall, not just school employees. I don't know the date certain, but it's
about halfway through June.
Halfway through June. Maybe. The last pay period begins. It's the first payroll of the next fiscal year.
Yeah, people need to understand that the state fiscal year runs from July 1st to June 30th of the following year. It's not on the calendar year.
Right. So that begins the talk of furloughs and layoffs of state employees. Well, that includes schools. People forget what goes on in our schools over the summer months. So there's summer school, all sorts of activities and programs. But what I spoke about in committee was the food program. We served 1.3 million meals last summer to children for whom that may well have been the only meal they had all day. And the estimate is 1.4 million this summer. That program is in jeopardy because although the food itself comes, you know, the money for it comes through the federal lunch program, the buildings have to be open, the personnel on the ground have to be there to serve. And without a resolution to this, that can't happen. Buildings can't just be locked for the summer. The systems in them, the HVAC, the computer systems, that, right. that all has to be powered down systematically. So we learned this last summer as the deadline was approaching. That will start about roughly a week ahead of time. So we really don't have the luxury of all the way till June 30th.
Which kind of begs the question, though, because and I know State House Blend listeners really like to get into the weeds of these things. Otherwise, they wouldn't be listening probably at this point for sure. But the process issue, and you talked about wanting to get the formula right, and then we can deal with the money, and the court can intervene and say, yes, that's enough, or no, it's not. But the timing also would suggest that it would be better to get it right in the first place.
Sure.
Rather than to have a jump through a bunch of hoops of evaluating whether it's enough, whether it's not enough, how much longer would that then delay resolution to this? So, I mean, you could understand the argument that we've got one shot here.
Absolutely.
We've got a Supreme Court order on the table. Why not get it right and know that we've got it right from the get-go?
Well, that's why my vote has always been on the larger side of the education funding plan. I mean, that is how I personally cast my vote, but that is how I've been voting. But it takes a majority, and that's not the opinion of the majority. So, okay, we'll go down this path. This is repeatedly how these cases have been handled. Last year, I helped move the first bill because I wanted the court to have it. And I said in my remarks on the House floor, I don't believe this will satisfy the court, but let's get on with it. And we did get it back and had to redo it. And it was a special session. And I did help move things along in special session. And we got the job done right.
I'm starting to get disturbing thoughts about seeing myself here and you guys still here in July.
I know. My birthday's June 29th. I love you guys, but I hope I'm home celebrating with my family.
Mine's December 30th, and I have some fear that we may still be back.
I'll split the difference
for
July 24.
Yeah. I want to get one more comment from you. You did two things I think that are important as we get closer and what's going to happen with the court. And one you talked about, one, the burden of proof is on the state to prove that this is an adequate and equitable funding solution. But I think the other thing that is important that we haven't talked too much about, although we talked about it in committee, when I say we, of course, I mean you, the court has been clear that they don't care how much money you can raise,
right.
that the funding amount has got to be adequate and equitable, and it makes no difference about how much you think you can raise. I think they're essentially saying you're the government. Go out and raise what you
right.
what you need to raise. Is that something that you think some members are not
Well, that's the horror of argument.
Are avoiding, right, is that notion that they're trying to, as they are with the
that's
tax
the Democrats
plan,
argument.
Right,
yeah.
the argument that, well, we just don't have that much money to spend, and the court doesn't really look at it that way. That's a big rub, isn't it?
Well, it is. And until last night, I had the quote. It was in my purse, and I'm sorry I took it out because it was, you know, it was from one of the lower court rulings, but it was my favorite passage of all time in terms of legal writing. They spoke to that this is a self-inflicted wound, I believe was the phrase, and they really didn't care that raising taxes is hard. Raising taxes is hard. But it doesn't excuse us from the responsibility to take care of
things. And that's the other thing that gets lost in this discussion sometimes is you've got this really monumental school funding case going on. It's been going on for years. And now you have an order on the table and you have the opportunity to maybe put that to bed for a long time.
Right.
Okay. And you're talking about a lot of money to do that. At the very same time, mm-hmm. you've got a budget deficit over the coming fiscal year and the year after that creeping up on $1 billion,
right.
which just – It's those are monumental challenges.
They are. They're historic in terms of the scope of the challenge.
And arguably, many would argue they are both self-inflicted wounds.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What are you going to do about it?
I've put my best foot forward, and I'm going to continue to try and find enough colleagues to come along and join us in solving it.
We're going to leave it there. This, as you know, is where we turn the podcast over to you. We turn State House Blend over to you. And I'm most eager, as we go past 90 days in the legislative session, as we talk about a sweltering July special session, what is your walk-off song?
Well, Sam, this is a little trite, but I like to let my iPod play randomly. And this morning on the way in, it played Don't Stop Believin' by Journey. And I think that's appropriate because I remain hopeful that we will get this done right, and keep our schools open.
You are a positive half glass, half full representative, and I salute you for it.
Thank you.
State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp, and today came from the KCUR studios in Topeka. I'm Sam Zeff, and I'll see you around the radio.
Living in a lonely world, she took the midnight train going in. Just a city boy, born and raised in South Detroit. He took the midnight train going anywhere.
That was from KCUR's political podcast, State House Blend, Kansas. To hear the full conversation, subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and on the NPR One app. On tomorrow's program, what entrepreneurship can do to limit unrest and extremism around the globe. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.